What I find perpetually mysterious is that science is so seldom represented in literature, and so seldom understood in either literature with a capital L, which typically means fiction by dead people, or by the popular culture, which mostly seems to look upon science as a convenient prop for a paranoid plot structure. And yet, science is the big driver in this century.
Science makes history. But as a science fiction writer, I mean, you must know, you practice the embodiment or rendering of science in your specific genre.
It's true, but science fiction has been a kind of a poor stepchild in literature for a long time, despite its origin with Verne's and Wells in the last century. And it has fallen into disrepute, or did, in fact, in the 1920s, when it became the stuff of pulp magazines. But it has seized the popular imagination in America and, I would say, around the world generally, and dominates popular culture now in a way that would have been completely implausible, say, even in the 1950s, when the march of science into the media began, I mean, in various loathsome ways, such as giant ant movies, but also in things like the great SF movies of, Forbidden Planet and The Day the Earth Stood Still and so forth. So it's a curious thing that science is represented in the popular culture mainly through these images of dominated by fear and of the low order, or what's held to be the lower order of popular culture. So, of course, popular culture is a thing which has a long history of suddenly becoming recognized as actually what was going on.
I mean, can we not say that in a sense the world has become science fiction, that science fiction is the unacknowledged legislator of our future lives, has witnessed everything from the obvious man on the moon to the perhaps less obvious but much more important personal computer carried around by people from place to place. And at the same time that has occurred, highbrow culture, which is dominated so overwhelmingly by people from the humanities and the arts, has completely ignored or resisted this whole facet of culture.
Right, and made themselves obsolete thereby. The art novel, for example, which is a recognized genre now, with its own audience, its marketing package, its publishing strategy, used to be the core of conventional fiction, and now it simply can't command that landscape. Things have gotten out of control.
I mean, would you agree that there's been like a bifurcation in the highbrow culture between those elements that still retain an affinity with the mass culture? An example of that might be Tom Wolfe, Bonfire of the Vanities, and those elements that clearly reject the broader culture and espouse some type of extreme ideology or stance.
Perhaps so. Could you give an example of the really extreme example?
Well, I guess I would think of someone like Foucault and some kind of bizarre Hegelian, Marxist, sadomasochistic nightmare ideology as an extreme example.
Yeah. In fact, it's an ideology of the extremes.
Yes, exactly.
That's
which has in many ways been inherent in ideology as a style of thinking since the mid-19th century.
That's right.
That very extremism.
There's not just Foucault, but there's the De Man scandal, for example, surrounding structuralism. A fellow who maintains that texts really are in a sense meaningless or introduces relativistic values on them, and then turns out to have been a Nazi propagandist.
I think that's perfect.
Yes. I mean, you have to admit that they are consistent.
Yes, clearly. The Goebbels world flows naturally.
Right.
Into many modern art movements. Well, in fact, the Nazis were an outgrowth of art movements in that they were heavily influenced by futurism, surrealism. So in a sense, they're coming back to their own.
That's right. Well, Hitler was a painter and a vegetarian.
An animal rights activist.
Right, an early animal rights activist. But it is mysterious to me still that our culture has been in an uneasy way, restlessly trying to deal with science, but does so almost pathologically. It never really represents scientists as people who employ what is, after all, mostly a matter of systematic common sense. That's what the scientific method is. It's not really mysterious. It really is a logical continuation, you might say, of ordinary Yankee ingenuity.
But perhaps the whole problem is that what you are seeing is the last stages of the war initiated by Galileo, at least in post-medieval times, between the men of science and their notion of how the world should work, or our notion of how the world should work, and the priests, shaman, conventional philosophers, where I use the term philosophy not in a technical sense, but in the sense of, in effect, careerist position. That is to say, we try to make our cases on the basis of evidence, logic, or persuasion. The other side, as it were, makes its cases primarily on the basis of some combination of received authority or arrogation of moral stature, as in the revolutionary elite of the Bolsheviks, or any other type of avant-garde art movement, which says, you know, we know the future, you don't, you're the Philistine bourgeois majority, therefore you have to suffer at our hands, which of course is what modern art is all about, and thus we will instruct you. I mean, there's this very big divide, and the second school, the what I call the shamanistic school, or the high brow culture school, of course, used to own everything. You know, in the 17th century, they were the entire educated elite, and at that time, their instruments of choice were the Bible and sometimes the writings of Aristotle. More recently, the conflict has, of course, become vastly broader, and not only have physicists sort of joined the fray, but then, of course, biologists have joined the fray, and economists, and the two sides are piling up in this gigantic cultural academic football game that sort of fights for two things. Of course, the soul of the university, where we mostly reside, and on the other hand, the soul of the culture as a whole.
That's true. That's true. I have a feeling that the humanities have largely lost their understanding of where the culture is going. They continually seem to be blindsided by events and scramble to adopt the latest ism, whatever it might be. What really bothers me about this abyss between the sciences and the humanities is that, first, few were attempting to build any bridges, and second, that it reflects in the culture as a whole. The general ignorance about science and the culture arises deeply from inadequate education, K through 12, and has an enormous impact on national politics, upon rational discussion. The standard style of the media now, either the fictionalized media or the so-called news media, is essentially paranoid. You can only report a scientific story with a high profile by making it induce paranoia in at least some fraction of the viewership. So the first question reporters learn to ask of anything new is, who does it threaten, not who does it help? So in your own field, in biology, the enormous emphasis on unwanted side effects. Gee, suppose this modified plant gets out, and instead of being a tomato that can resist frost, turns out to be a tomato that likes to eat other plants or other people, it's hard to imagine what these people can imagine. But there's a bias in favor of the artificiality introduced by human technology as being rapacious.
Mm-hmm. I would call this the Jeremy Rifkin syndrome.
Yeah.
Overwhelmingly. Well, I think it really reflects this clash of two worlds, two cultures, and C.P. Snow's terminology, but actually more profound than two cultures. It's two futures or it's a past wrestling with the future. If the world is to be rationally apprehended by the tools of science, mathematics, evidence, logical persuasion, then it has a certain character to it in which threats can be real threats and yet still quantitatively evaluated, still discussed on an evidential basis. Or we could live in a Kafkaesque world of nightmares burgeoning everywhere, of weird and bizarre transformations of which we can make no sense. And so long as we have an educational system and a culture, certainly the highbrow humanities-oriented culture, which fosters the paranoia of which you speak, then that sort of ammunition in favor of this dark, funereal, Wagnerian future with all of the irrationality and all of the sort of blood force and anxiety that I think that the shamanistic humanities culture requires to survive. The more we radiate a blinding light, the more they have to shrink.
Hmm. Well, you know, you're bringing up Snow is really right on the mark, because C.P. Snow was a major intellectual figure of the 50s and 60s in Britain. And regrettably, he's very little remembered now. But he brought up the whole idea of the two cultures and pushed it in a series of lectures at Cambridge. And I reread those a year or so ago, plus the essay he wrote afterward, reflecting on it. His real point about the two cultures was that it crippled the advanced nations in their attempting to uplift the bulk of nations, that the division actually hampered any of the long-term goals of the human race. If there's anything I think most people would agree about, it's that for fundamental reasons we should attempt to increase the level, to uplift the lot of so many people who live in abysmal ignorance and poverty.
You mean in the humanities?
No, I don't mean the humanities department.
Intellectual poverty.
I mean the geographical south versus the geographical north, largely, although actually I would argue that perhaps what we used to call a third world ought to be now extended to cover the second world, since it's in a state of obvious decrepitude. But Snow said, unless we follow these more modern ways of analyzing problems and encouraging rational debate, we are going to deliver ourselves into the hands of people who will be unable to help humanity. That there is a way out of the abyss of poverty and ignorance, and it has been demonstrated now in modern times. And some intelligent adapting of that to the tropical nations, let's call them, is the way to go. And it means lots of things, such as population control.
So let me offer you two things. Mm-hmm. The first one is, you know, rather than two cultures, Galileo proposed the existence of three, which, from my understanding, which is, of course, limited, were the sort of biblically derived, the Aristotelian and his system, the sort of modern mm-hmm. science-based systems that we now operate within, you and I. So this kind of multiple worlds distinction is, in fact, a very long-standing, multiple worlds of both intellect and approach to life. And the second point I would make comes from one of your fellow science fiction authors, Ari Lafferty, in Past Master, in which he contrasts a utopian Brave New World kind of system planned by technocrats with the reaction of people to that technocratic world and their abandonment of the technocratic world to live in complete squalor. And I think a very deep issue for people like us sitting around a table talking like H.G. Wells did in the 1930s is that we have to face the fact that rational or technocratic or scientifically oriented approaches to any problem may not appeal to people because they believe strongly in Allah, the revolution, God, New York expressionist art forms, sadomasochistic sex with boys, whatever. They may have all of those tastes and inclinations they are absolutely unwilling to give up in the face of our bland proposals of efficiency or compromise or effective design.
That's true. We've, of course, ignored the bureaucrats, who are the kind of the pseudo-rational. That is, they are not so interested in the frontiers of knowledge as they are in control, which is...
Or really, power.
Yeah, power, which is another issue. Scientists don't have power, except by long range. I mean, scientists have changed the terms of strategic warfare fundamentally and forever by inventing things.
We've changed the terms of reproduction, writing letters, of driving to and from work.
Right. Through the implications of technology, but also through the worldview. I mean, the fact that, after all, it's we who are in the end responsible for a great deal of the angst and ennui that comes from the modern age. That is, we have displaced humanity from the center of creation.
But is that not, I think, a modern fiction, that modernity is responsible for our ills? To what extent, you know, were there ills 400 years ago before modernity was really ever a problem?
Oh, because
that's
ills.
One of the classic unexamined questions.
Yeah, that's true. There were different ills.
That's an ideology which, to some extent, was put forward by Rousseau, was picked up by Marx, and is transmitted by every sort of lumpen intellectual assistant professor of sociology. That, you know, modernity is awful, and somehow we try to struggle with it. What's impressive to me is when you survey real people and ask them about concrete choices that they face given technologies like things like telephones and cars. So, you know, would they really be willing to give up those things one by one? And the answer is almost always no by the vast majority. The things that are out there that people have that highbrow culture despises, like network television, still appeal to a very large fraction of people and may not be sources of alienation or inconvenience or any of those other things or Rifkin-esque paranoia, but may in fact be comforting, supportive, and useful to everyday people who, you know, are not faculty at universities.
Yeah. It's the polyester leisure suit argument, that it's hopelessly déclassé, but lots of people like it. And it is more comfortable than burlap, anyway.
or hair shirts.
Although I don't much like it. I think there's a lot of logic to what you say. It's been a long kernel, long time coming in Western literature as it tries to confront science. I remember that, take the original text, Frankenstein. And the interesting thing about that book, now, of course, transmogrified into all kinds of films, is that everyone takes Frankenstein to be the name of the monster, but it's the name of the scientist. What does the scientist do upon every appearance of the monster? He goes literally, and this is quoting Mary Shelley, into a swoon, like a heroine in a Victorian novel. He swoons away and is literally unconscious when the monster appears in his deadly manifestations and in fact carries off the scientist's bride and so on, which is a little obvious, but it can't be mistaken. The monster is the scientist's unconscious, it seems to me. And what the text is saying is that there's something deep and dark buried inside this urge to knowledge, that knowledge is dark.
Well, is there something deep and dark buried inside the urge to knowledge, or is there simply something deep and dark buried within us, period, which scientists will suppress, disguise, or avoid as they pursue their trade?
Yeah. Well, you're right. I think Frankenstein attempts to turn the discussion back to the inner resources and deep swamps of the scientist and say, well, in a sense, well, you're no better than us, maybe you're worse.
Mm-hmm.
Ignoring the fact that what science attempts to do is to get the swamp at least temporarily out of our arguments so that we can understand the world without being possessed by all of the other elements about our being.
But the shamanistic impulse and similarly the sort of aggressive art movements of the 20th century clearly endeavor to exploit that underlying core. Wagner is a perfect example of this.
Yes.
Just this effort to get into the deep, dark recesses, bring them up to the surface, and then, in a sense, have them rule. And that, of course, is exactly what the Nazis exploited in their whole system of hypnotizing the German population. I mean, unlike the Bolsheviks, the Nazis were an overwhelmingly popular political movement. in Germany in their day. This, I think, really is the only reason why there is still the ongoing struggle between the side of sort of Galilean modern scientific rationalism or empiricism on the one hand, and high culture, art culture, deconstructionism, and all the rest, is this element that comes from, obviously, the rest of the brain. I think that's one of the crucibles for our understanding of ourselves. Evidently, that is the Freudian territory, and that's what Freud brought forward at the turn of the century, and then Jung and Adler and all of the descendants of them sort of kept stirring the pot on. And that's something, clearly, as scientists, we have not yet successfully dealt with the questions that Freud raised and that Hitler embodied in what he was doing. And you could say, turning around, that someone like Foucault embodies. There we are. I think that's also what was in Ari Lafferty's Past Master, is the, or for that matter, Aldous Huxley's Brave New World, the unyielding irrationality at the core of at least some of human behavior and experience.
Yes. But nobody really wants to banish irrationality, because after all, aesthetics is irrational too. It's just that...
Well, we don't deal with it.
Right, we don't deal with it, right.
We just evade the problem.
Yeah.
So it's out there for everyone else to pick up on, from Wagner to Foucault to anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so long as that is the case, then the sort of one-eyed man in the kingdom of the blind metaphor continues to apply to science.
Yeah.
Because we don't see it with the other eye. So we're walking into things, clunk, and those things are those irrationalities, those pervasive paranoias, which you alluded to in the case of the horror movies, or, you know, real-world disasters like fascism.
Right. And there's a great fear, actually, I believe, in the culture, that too much emphasis on understanding ourselves will lead to the kind of control that everyone fears. And Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange, as given in particularly Kubrick's film, is in the end about how the irrepressible self will still beat this new form of social control. And in fact, it's horrific, but it's also very clear who you're supposed to identify with in that movie.
It always is. I mean, yeah. It's never the sort of technocratic rationalist who is the point of identification, but always some earnest, typically imperfect, emotionally intense young man, very rarely young woman, which is interesting, who is, of course, the focus of our affections.
That's right. Occasionally, there's some variations. Let's think of a popular movie, say, Jaws. There's a scientist in Jaws, and he lectures us about sharks. And he has a hand in putting down the irrational, the dark force out of the sea, although it's actually the cop, the village policeman, who dispatches the shark in the end. But the scientist is kind of a... he's not the amusing sidekick. He's the logical sidekick of the force of order.
And typically, the scientist, like, what was the guy's name? The part played by Christopher Lloyd in Back to the Future, Doc Brown.
Yes.
Is typically portrayed as somewhat ineffectual and very one-eyed. You know, Christopher Lloyd's character in Back to the Future is typically klutzy and mistaken in how he thinks that things are going to work. And I think that is a very crude evocation of the sense that people have that sort of the modern rational scientific world still is not yet able to cope with the full spectrum of human nature or the human situation.
It's true. It may never be able to, after all. But there are all these fears running through this. I've often wondered, in fact, why science fiction in the popular media, particularly in films, has been able to suddenly capture the central ground of discussion. I mean, something like 5 out of the top 10 grossing films of all time are science fiction. And the interesting thing is that none of them are directly taken from science fiction text. They are transmogrifications of lots of SF ideas at the hands of very adept filmmakers. So even when a film like Aliens, for example, is a big hit and is very gloomy, gothic science fiction, it comes from a short story written by A.E. Van Vogt called Discord in Scarlet. It's been ripped free of attribution, no acknowledgement to Van Vogt in the film, which was a matter of a lawsuit. The Hollywood instinct is to believe in the Promethean legend that all these ideas spring full-blown from a brow of graduates of USC. But it ain't so. It really does come out of something deep in the culture that's been hatching for a long time. But I don't quite understand, in a way, why science fiction has been able to take over the terms of discussion. It is almost as though the field has been abandoned by other forces.
Well, we live in the world of science fiction.
Yeah.
As I said earlier, I mean, mm-hmm. our present was science fiction's past. Science fiction was the only literature which really was coming close to preparing us for our world, the world that we live in. And in science fiction, I think actually an interesting point is, as you yourself illustrated with one of the first great science fiction novels, Frankenstein, is that science fiction very early on had the conflict between the rationality, the logic,
yeah.
the scientific attempt to understand, mm-hmm. on the one hand, on the other hand, the dark forces of irrationality and the unconscious. The science fiction blended those things and presents their tension, and that's the tension that we all live with. I think in the Middle Ages, where you had, for everyone essentially, leaving aside a few scholars of Greek texts, everyone lived in an irrational world, dominated by irrational forces. There was no rationality, true rationality, counterposed to irrationality. You just had this sea of irrationality of various types, where there was the good irrationality, you identified with the Christian God, and the various other types of dark irrationality, which you identified with the devil or unreconstructed original sin human nature. But we all lived in that world completely.
Yes.
Along comes Galileo, along comes the modern world, and empirical rationality comes in, and the tension starts to build, and we still live with that tension.
Yeah. It's getting greater and greater. You see it, the kind of acknowledged greatest science fiction film of all time, 2001, has at the core, its deep, long plot problem is the computer HAL, who disrupts this mission. And it turns out it's because he was programmed to essentially lie and to conceal, and he couldn't do it. It's a bit hard to understand.
So in a sense, he went on to greater evils.
Yeah, that's right. It's a clear moral lesson there.
But think about the opening sequence of that very film, which was not about hell.
Right.
It wasn't even the terribly bland trip to the moon. It was a bunch of primates,
mm-hmm.
expertly made up, from human actors, discovering the violent use of tools against conspecifics. It was the discovery of evil.
Yes.
It was the discovery of power.
Yes, tools as evil.
And the very bone with which our killer primate killed the other primates who were killed is tossed up into the sky and becomes a piece of the orbiting... human artifact around mm-hmm. the planet. From technology coupled with evil and aggression comes the future technological development. I mean, obviously the atomic bomb is the perfect illustration of the marriage of technology and evil.
Yes.
And the potential for spectacular destruction. And there it was. Now, HAL was, I think, a relatively... To me, as a plot device, relatively unimpressive, but that's...
Yeah, well, I didn't think it worked
science fiction
well, but yes,
consumer.
It was there. No, but those terrific images, that whole front end of the movie, by the way, was shot after Kubrick had, quote, finished the film, unquote.
Oh, really?
And he was forced to put a frame around the movie, and that was it.
Well, now, who forced him?
The studio.
The studio.
Yes, oh, bad, studio. Bad studios. Always bad for the creator. But in fact, they actually improved that movie a great deal. Because I remember Arthur Clarke telling me that some studio exec came out and said, I can't figure this movie out. I don't know what it's about. We open up and there's the spaceship. I mean, what's, you know, blah, blah, blah. So Kubrick, to keep down the budget, he gave us 28 minutes with no speaking parts. Right? And shot it in the open, by the way, outside London.
Wow.
Just did some background stills. Still shots for Africa, and shot the whole thing on a platform outside London.
Fantastic.
But I mean, people who have, you see, the standard romantic image of the artist from whom everything springs full blown, never acknowledge that most of what's really interesting about the popular culture of the 20th century is participatory and collaborative. Films certainly are.
Absolutely.
But what really strikes me is that America is so weirdly obsessed with, and the level of the Department of Humanities, a kind of inferiority complex about this. They really think in terms of the shibboleths of the 19th century, that you know, what's really important is novels, and symphonies, and maybe even epic poems. But what America is good at is its inventions. Oh, it dominates popular culture because, say, look at music, the Broadway musical, jazz, rock and roll, blues, even rap music, if you want to count that. But in fiction, it's invented most of the major genres and dominates them utterly. The modern hard-boiled detective, the modern suspense story, science fiction, modern fantasy.
I thought Casanova invented science fiction.
No, he invented the romance novel, which also is dominated by Americans, although out of a long lineage. And, of course, there's always the Western.
Yes.
Another stage for moral debate.
Perhaps one question we could address is a difference between, say, American culture on the one hand and European culture in terms of their experience of the tensions between scientific rationality on the one hand and the, you know, arts, the dark unconscious on the other hand.
In that sense, I think 2001 as a film is a European film.
Interesting.
Made by Kubrick, a guy from the Bronx, and Clark, a guy from Sussex, isn't it? No, sorry. No, I'm sure I've got it wrong, but south of London. I think the Europeans are actually better at this than we are, though they have less energy.
Less synergy or less energy?
Either synergy or energy.
Interesting. I mean, it's certainly true that they've shown themselves very good at not getting along with each other in this century. So there's the synergy. Could one say something like the following, and I'm just offering this as like a cliche to discuss. Is it true that American civilization is a more technocratic, rationalist, empirically oriented civilization in which the dark, unconscious Wagnerian elements are relatively suppressed compared to the Europeans who have more dark Wagnerian elements at the surface? Or is that wrong?
Gee, I honestly don't know how to even think about it. It's very hard, you know, as a fish to understand the sea. It's very hard as an American to swim in this culture and to truly see it. We feel it intuitively. There are writers like J.G. Ballard who stand outside American culture and write about it obsessively. And to him, everything is fraught with meaning. But to us, a freeway is a freeway. It's a way of getting someplace. To him, it's a metaphor. Wow. So the difference between us and the Europeans is that we've now dominated the popular cultural landscape and also the ideological landscape for so long. But it's been amazingly unconscious in many ways.
Is that not a characteristic of American culture, that it's amazingingly unconscious?
Yes, right.
One difference to me is the self-consciousness of European culture.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll go around talking about culture, and they will have television programs on the big networks, prime time, about culture, capital C.
Yes.
Which you would never see here.
That's right. And I think it's because culture is so bound up with class in Europe, whereas in the United States, our great popular culture almost always comes welling up from below. Jazz, rock and roll, they were not invented by guys on government grants.
Almost all of those popular music forms are, in fact, African American. I mean, they invented virtually all except country and western.
Right. But the genres, they were invented in low-life pulp magazines, mostly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Although, were there not some genres invented in Victorian England the Penny Dreadfuls?
Oh, yeah. Things that don't affect me very much, but I kind of recognize their power. Things like, say, Star Trek. Obviously, it comes out of some kind of earlier antecedents. Mr. Spock is actually, of course, Sherlock Holmes. He is the rational engine. And we benefit by being amused by him, yet fascinated with him. It was a piece of genius to put him in that show.
Mm.
These things are really deep cultural discussions that go way back. And he's supposed to stand for scientific rationality.
That's interesting. I mean, one of the few heroic embodiments of scientific rationality, because many people, mm-hmm. not just Trekkies, are huge fans of the Spock character.
Yeah.
But of course, at the same time, Spock is always portrayed as a character with tremendous limitations, or struggling with tremendous limitations.
Yeah. Right.
And Kirk, who is the more sort of ordinary or everyman figure, is the one with the full range of feeling, the full range of possible styles of thought, unlike Spock, which is so narrowly constrained. Is this a reflection of our cultural notion that to be fully human, you can't be fully rational?
Hmm. Could be. I mean, Captain Kirk is a guy who doesn't know science, but he knows what he likes. You know, as the old cliche has it about, I don't know nothing about art, but I know what I like. Actually, exact parallel, I think, to Jaws. Captain Kirk is the village sheriff, policeman.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And Spock is the scientist who comes on and tells him how sharks work.
Mm-hmm.
I think, actually, that what you say is true, that what the deep popular culture is telling us is an uneasiness, because Spock never gets to run the show. See, he's useful, but he doesn't get to run the show.
And I think the audience will basically be more comfortable with that.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Spock doesn't have any persuasive rhetoric the way the leader figures do.
Mm-hmm.
He produces results, not rhetoric. And rhetoric is the lubricant of society.
And is rhetoric the sort of natural excrescence of shamanistic culture, where you stand up and talk about patriotism or God or mm-hmm. Mithra or the cosmic oneness or whatever else you're selling? People, as witness, yet another episode of cult hysteria and violence, people cling powerfully to those things, to my ear, totally unjustified assertions, completely absurd demagogy and rhetoric, patently implausible reasoning, and all the rest of it. And they buy it in large quantities.
Right. Well, Oscar Wilde, as usual, said it best, how did it go? In matters of supreme significance, style is always more important than substance.
And there was the 1980s.
Yes. Well, there was a lot of that in every time. I really rather wonder about how we as scientists can reach the people in our culture and persuade them that if they just understood the habits of mind of science, we could solve problems by something other than rhetoric. That science is not a lot of bony, icy results, and certainly not just sheets of facts.
Certainly not that.
The, you know, like the old game shows, the $60,000 question, people seem to have the notion that being educated means you have memorized a lot. Whereas, in fact, I have a fairly terrible memory, and I make a habit of not remembering things so that I must look them up, so that I at least get them right.
Well, you never would have gone into medical school.
Yes, I've never been a doctor. Doctors have to carry a lot of info right up here because they need it very quickly. Physicists seldom do. A good memory is always an asset, but it's a minor tool in understanding anything.
Well, it's a basic tool which crosses all cultural differences. You know, if you're Wagner or Hitler and press the right buttons, you have to know when to remember to hit the right buttons and where the buttons are located.
Yeah, which actually Hitler was terrible at running things.
Thank goodness.
Yes, thank goodness. He really mismanaged the Second World War dreadfully by running it himself.
Yes.
If he'd let the German General Staff have control, we would be speaking German. If I could get one thing across, I think, to the great mind of the American Republic, it would be that the simple matter of understanding the common sense way that science proceeds, and of understanding basic things like, you know, a simple idea of statistics, for example, and risk, for example, about which we're completely irrational in this society. Spending $1 billion to protect, save one life for, say, near a nuclear reactor, and not spending the $75,000 that it costs on average to save a life on the interstate highway system. We could manage the society without turning it into some kind of brittle, brave new world run by autocrat managers.
Could we? I mean, what would the full Galilean modern Western scientific society be like?
Gosh, nobody's ever tried it.
I don't know. I mean, a question in my mind is whether or not Madison and Jefferson didn't in fact try it in the United States.
Well, okay.
But this isn't in fact the closest thing that anyone has ever come to. You know, the American Constitution was one of the very first attempts to deliberately contrive an apparatus of government that would work.
That's right.
For the greater good, meaning utilitarian good, as opposed to all of the older systems which were based on rights, prerogatives, powers, and all those other things.
Yes, it was run the way Manhattan is today.
You know, perhaps this is the best that can be done, and if we, as scientists, think that we'll ever push the irrational, Wagnerian, and destructive elements of human nature farther away than this, we're kidding ourselves.
Yeah, that we're kidding about. But the mere matter of making better decisions because you understand something about how the world works, that's a much less ambitious thing. I'd like to see us try that. We can take on Wagner later. Maybe.
But you can't just choose what your culture will be. You can't just say,
no.
I will be this, and that's all there is to it. Any way of experiencing the world or perceiving the world, as science illustrates, as humanities illustrate, is founded on a relatively deep cultural matrix. You know, the cultural matrix of science goes back hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, to the Greeks.
Oh, yes.
And similarly, you know, the critical approach of the humanities patently goes back to the Greeks. You can't just wave a magic wand and say, well, you know, now we'll look at risk more objectively.
Yes.
Because, of course, one's perceptions of risk grow out of how much Rifkin-esque hysteria is floating around in the ambient culture.
Right.
How you were taught to deal with questions of risk as a child, and thus it has to do with what your parents were like and their values. And so I guess I'm not one who believes that we can suddenly decide to be more rational about any question without broadly advancing the culture of rational or empirical thought.
Well, I think that's unfortunately true, that we can't have spot solutions, that we've got to have a sea change in society. Unfortunately, when you realize that, it makes the task so gargantuan that it promotes mere lassitude, not ambition, because it seems like such a prodigious project. But I have some hope. I have some hope.
Well, clearly Galileo did.
Yes.
I mean, there he was, living in a world which is overwhelmingly irrational.
Right.
With just the small elements of rationality inherited from the classical Greeks.
And yet,
he and to a lesser extent Hobbes and people like them began to develop rational, modern, Western styles of thinking.
Yeah. So it's not impossible. But how to do it? Well, that's a subject perhaps for another discussion.
Another day.
Yes, another day.